Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books. And this week I'm talking to Charles Robbins about his novel, The Accomplice. Which is very, very timely. In fact, I should say we actually rushed it to get it in before the election. It's a tale of somebody who is tied into Nebraska Senator Tom Peel's presidential campaign when he's thrown out, and he searches around and finds a somewhat unprincipled Republican trying to search for the middle ground. I couldn't help almost being deafened by the echoes here, Charles. So what inspired this book, and how closely tied is it to reality? Is this a bravely named version of Anon by Joe Klein and Primary Colors?
Well, the bravery depends on your point of view, but Ian, I've lived this stuff. This is in some ways a sensitive point you've started with. I've lived the stuff of politics, government, the stuff of The Accomplice for 20 years as an apparatchik, I suppose you'd say, for political campaigns, ran press shops for a fascinating guy named Fred Grandy, who kind of obscure now, but he was a television actor, or was actually classically trained stage actor, wound up as on a situation comedy, romantic comedy, The Love Boat, and he's very much the basis of two of the characters. Grandy was sort of larger than life, so there's a fair bit of Grandy in Peel, though I'd like to think the lighter side, and a fair bit of Grandy in Doug Tyler, who is a more minor character. And then 2 years later, since I was told I'd paid my dues and I really ought not to jump out of the game, I ran the press shop for Senator Arlen Specter's 1996 cycle.
In political terms, the type of independent centrist thinking that Arlen Specter stood for is not just dead, it's buried at the crossroads with a stake through its heart at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, when I was in the game, we used to say we were an endangered species, but I think it's safe to say at this point extinct. But I do see some final paroxysms of the moderate, the center, centrist Republicans. But to give you a very quick answer to your earlier question, so these characters are composites, but they are based in large part from my experience. I kept daily journals, nightly journals, sort of poured out my heart, my soul, my liver. And there is, I'd like to think, a fair bit of what we call the uninventable detail when you see it, that just had to have happened because nobody could make it up. But yeah, to your point about centrists, Specter was arguably the last man standing, and he's no longer standing. There is one member of the original Wednesday lunch group, as they called themselves, in the Senate, or will be as soon as this year ends, and that's Senator Susan Collins of Maine. And after that, there's nobody left from the Republican Center, not in the Senate, and the House was decimated long before that. But I take some hope in seeing some of the guys who didn't get in, but maybe almost did. Like Mitch Daniels or Rob Portman, even though I think they'd be outraged if I called them a centrist, or a guy whom I like didn't get too far. John Huntsman did get in and got out quickly. So there's some stirrings, kind of like a tree. You cut it off at the base, and sometimes the roots sprout again.
Yes, you flog apple trees with chains and they bring forth better fruit, I've been told. But I must say, I attacked mine with a chainsaw and all it produced was stumps. So I'm not going to can't be totally optimistic with your own grace for the future.
Well, but maybe we'll have better luck.
Yeah, that's on a political level. The change since I came, I've been in this country for over 20 years, and when I came, I actually had acquaintances with quite a lot of the old-style New York Republicans, who were often way to the left of the old-style Southern Democrats.
These guys like Jack Javits, those characters.
But now you think about it, the Southern Democrats are sort of now the current reactionary Republicans, so they're in their proper place. You could say that the lines have been. it's not so much that there's been a change; it's more that the lines are more accurately depicted now, perhaps. But the centrist group of Republicans has disappeared without trace, hasn't it? As you said, so
it has, and to the detriment of the entire process. My next book, and I'm not trying to plug it, but the next book comes out in January. It's a collaboration with former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, who's a Democrat. And Daschle very much bemoans the death of the political center, because that's where the deals were made. That's where compromises took place. And with the polarization and in both camps, there's no common meeting ground. And we see this repeatedly. I guess the next big example is going to be the fiscal cliff, or is the fiscal cliff. But in the old days, you're talking about, Ian, when you arrived here on the scene back in 20 years ago, in the 80s and the 90s, there were centrist deal makers, and I don't say deal making in a bad way. I don't mean to suggest that a little grease keeps the wheels moving and we all rise above principle or anything like that. I mean, there was an understanding that the country had to get together, the Senate had to meet and make things happen, and that does not seem to be the driving ethos anymore. Very much to the detriment of the country, and we'll see how close we get to this fiscal cliff.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fine distinction from the Democrat side, of course, the blue dog Democrats who actually sabotage implementation when there is a majority. That's a different cut from deal making, where it's much better if there's a flawed piece of legislation to improve it rather than have a binary yes or no vote on something. It's
No, that's right. And sometimes the process is the enemy of the product. If it's any solace to your listeners, the blue dogs have been decimated. There are so few of them left that they're really not too much of a factor.
I think most of our listeners will be quite reassured with that news. Apart from that, before we should get back onto the book and the fictional aspects. I always thought that one of the big contributions of Britain to the rest of the world was the paradoxical concept of a loyal opposition. As you know, I've lived through the days when I was working for British Labour leader Neil Kinnock, he was the leader of Her Majesty's loyal opposition. And of course, in most parts of the world, in the Third World, the idea of a loyal opposition is oxymoronic. You're either with us or against us. And that seems to be the concept that's totally missing here. The idea that the President of the United States can't land on a devastated beach in New Jersey and walk with the governor of that state without the governor being denounced for treachery. This is beyond Third World almost, isn't it?
It is, and there are some lines I used in the book. I used them almost as gag lines, but they were other uninventable details, such as a political consultant who had grown up in the Nixon camp, but he was fairly hard right, and he wrote us off the first time, first group meeting. He dismissed us literally and figuratively and said, "You're all a bunch of amateurs, intellectuals, and communists. You leave the big thinking to me." And it was a comment I suppose we all took at two levels. On the one hand, it was just so much in-your-face humor. On the other hand, there was more than a germ of truth to it. There is a real trench mentality, bunker mentality. Either you're with us or you're against us, and nothing can be more important. I can just, to your point, you can just feel the vibe from the Republican operatives who say nothing can be bigger. They have language. We're going to retake the country, as I think it was Stephen Colbert asked, from whom are you retaking it? But they're going to retake the country, and anything and everything else is subordinate, including, I suppose, the state of New Jersey being underwater.
And the state of the economy, it would appear, with the cliffhangers. There was a serious indications that the Tea Party did not mind bringing the world financial system to ruin if it meant that they did not have a person of a certain skin color in the White House as a result.
Well, I don't know if it was, I would boil it down exactly, completely to racism, but it certainly, I'm with you as far as their agenda was concerned, to the point that, what the heck, I'll name him, Jim DeMint, Senator from South Carolina, arguably the leader, the Senate leader of the Tea Party movement, is now famous for having said that health care was going to be Obama's Waterloo and we're going to destroy him. And and not to beat up too much on the Republicans, but the agenda for the next 4 years, this is back in 2009, was going to be, quote, to make Obama a one-term president. And if that's your agenda and that's your mindset, it doesn't bode well for any kind of accomplishment. But I Ian, in the book, that was more backdrop.
Well, exactly. That's what I was coming on to now. Let's remind our listeners, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I'm talking to Charles Robin about his gripping and enjoyable novel, The Accomplice. And since we're always interested in writers and getting published here, did you get a commission for this, or was this part of your late night diary writing that you sort of diverted your the ink from your veins from your diary to the novel and then presented it for publication?
The latter, Ian. This was a 18, depending how you count it, 18 year odyssey. But I've published fiction and nonfiction, and my understanding is that I've got a long way to go before I reach the rarefied levels where I can sell a novel without a final manuscript. There, you correct me, you would know better than I, but my strong understanding is you really have to be an established author before you can pull that off. And I'm told that, good as the reviews have been on this one, that I'm not going to be able to sell the next one without finishing it. And that's okay. My agent is beyond hopeful, says we should be in good shape if you do a nice job on the next one. But I'm not there yet, Ian, if I ever do get there. So I wrote this, poured various bodily organs into it, heart, soul, and liver. But I needed to finish it before I could shop it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's roughly what I expected to hear. I mean, it's been... These are hard times for writers with publishers, and they now have electronic means at their disposal. They can check immediately to see how your previous work sold, and if your debut novel doesn't sell as a bestseller, then you're likely to be relegated to a life in purgatory, or as the midlist is called.
Yeah, well, yes and no. Again, I defer to you. You must know the market far better than I. But my basic understanding, and reinforced from what my editors and agent have told me, is that the idea, like anything else, is to exceed expectations. So nobody expected that The Accomplice would top the bestseller list. That would have been very nice. But what it needed to do was exceed fairly modest expectations in terms of a print run for a first novel. I have not seen the numbers yet, but anecdotally, my understanding is we've done that and then some. The trick is that gets you another shot, but the trick is a publisher is going to be willing only so long to keep you along, as you would say, in the midlist or worse, meaning the expectations go way up for the next book. Then you've really got to perform.
Well, several of the authors we've interviewed on here had published some respectable books and then decided that rather than relying upon the vagaries of publishers' publicity budgets and the economic crisis, they would self-publish and make more money. And some of them have been very successful with it, because It is true that the publishing industry looks dire on one level, but people are buying a lot more books and they're buying a lot more formats now. So there is hope. There is hope.
Well, Ian, this is a matter of, I suppose it's a matter of opinion, but since you've raised the question, it happens to be very important to me. Self-publishing is a line I don't think I will ever cross. There were a number of years when I thought my baby was never going to come into the world. And the temptation, the obvious temptation was, well, why don't you self-publish it? And I didn't. I resisted for any number of reasons, one of which is importunings from everybody in the, establishment, who said, once you do that, you vitiate your brand, you ruin yourself. Secondly, having critics really like you out there to bless, to vet these books is an extraordinary gift to the community, but I'm not that much of a Democrat with a small D that I would be willing to pick something up without the blessing and frankly, without the screening of the establishment, starting with New York City with the publishing houses. Putting it bluntly, if you can't get one publishing house to take a chance on your book, maybe you're not ready for prime time.
This is true. The ones I'm talking about are people who have been published in the past and just decided that they could actually get better returns from doing it themselves when they looked, because publishers are not very good at selling books sometimes. But let's get back to the craft of fiction here. I mean, this is a thriller. Was this a genre that sort of... How do you see this? Is this a sort of murder story, or is it a... Because you've got several quite strong characters in here, including the enigmatic cop who is who's sort of in the background and doing your hero favors, and of course you've got some pretty nasty characters around who are, but many of whom are sort of morally ambiguous, like your Teamster leader.
Yeah, he's a brisky, tough guy. Well, Ian, my goal from the outset was to offer, if you will, a marriage of art and commerce. Meaning, I know I wanted to bring the book into the world, which meant I had to write something that was compelling, that was a page turner. I'd like to think, at least to an extent, I pulled that off. But I also wanted to produce something of some literary merit, to create characters, and I'm thrilled that they seem to have resonated, at least to an extent, with you. I wanted to do both. As you know well, there's a real schism in the writing world between the literary types and the commercial types. And what I would say is, kind of like the politicians, Alvin Barkley, who was Senate Majority Leader, then became Harry Truman's vice president. Somebody asked Barkley, what does it take to be a great senator? And Barkley said, first you have to get elected. And my attitude is, it's the same thing with writing. It doesn't matter how good the book is. If nobody's going to publish it, it just sits in a desk drawer. And again, I'm not going to go the self-publishing route. So, Ian, long way around the barn. But from the outset, I wanted to produce something of literary merit with that resonated, that had some important themes, that created characters somewhat indelibly, but also with one eye on the marketplace. So it was a combination.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, for example, in Joe Klein's Primary Colors, the President Clinton
yeah.
was the subject that was being who was being examined under constant examination from different angles. In yours, your focus is on your sort of role as a campaign worker and the moral dilemmas involved. And I think where you've moved from being just a caricaturish genre writing to a serious, quote, literary, unquote, fiction is the fact that so many of your characters are morally ambiguous. You know, few of them anyway, angels and devils. Each of them have their dilemmas and worries. Even some of the bad guys look as though they have their positive sides.
No, Ian, I very much appreciate that. There was another element I shot for, or an advantage I thought I had, with the greatest respect to Joe Klein, who is a master. Let me take a shot at being, I don't know if there's an award you give out for most arrogant guest, but let me give it a shot. What I brought to this that Joe Klein did not have is I was there on the inside. Now, Klein is a genius, and he's covered politics for eons, and no doubt he has good relationships with all kinds of heavy hitters, but he was not there, for example, in the men's room when, what the heck, I'll see if I can do this in a PG version, when Arlen Specter advised me to wash my hands before and after I did my business. And that is one uninventable detail. No matter how much time a journalist like Joe Klein spends with whoever it might be, the guy meaning the senator or of that level, is never going to give Joe Klein that kind of advice or let Joe Klein overhear it. There's another, if I may, another quick bit. I won't say who did this, but a politician who had a gift for humiliating took a a sucking candy wrapped in cellophane, one of those red and yellow, red and white cinnamon twirls, inserted it into his mouth, pulled the cellophane off with his teeth so that it was spit-stained, spit-slicked, and pinching it between two fingers, just held it out. He was in a car in front of another aide's face until the other aide, confused and befuddled, took the thing and sat there holding it. And that was a gift for humiliation that the senator had. That's in the book, too, another uninventable detail. There's just no way a guy like Joe Klein could see that or capture it, and he didn't. And his book is wonderful. It's magical, but he doesn't have that kind of detail. He has the same kind of Clinton-esque observations. Clinton as a listener in a physical act of exertion. That was how he described, more or less, Clinton's listening. And it was beautiful because Joe Klein is a master, but it didn't get to the level of the men's room or the spit-stained sucking candy that Joe Klein would never see.
So you've just recalled a memory for me when I was working on the CAPE campaign in 1987 with Kinnock. It turned out that the whole office filled with public school boys, not one of them knew how to press a pair of trousers without with an iron and a damp tea cloth.
Yeah, well,
so it was self-employed yours truly who ended up pressing the potential prime ministerial trousers. I volunteered, but nobody else knew how to. I thought, I've got to help these hapless buggers out.
Well, there you go, Ian. That's the uninventable detail. Now, you tell me that any reporter would ever be witness to something like that. Would never happen. Just wouldn't happen. The guys who, the Paragon, these, I still think it's the Paragon. It's a book called The Gay Place. Sort of the name was, the title came long before the term has its current usage, by a guy named Billy Lee Blammer, who was Lyndon Johnson's speechwriter and top aide when Johnson was Senate Majority Leader. Blammer's book, it is not just that God is in the details, but the details are not drama in themselves. But Blammer, maybe better than anybody, captured that kind of inside insight that that you just have to be there to do. And I say this, again, going for your most arrogant guest award, because very few of us, Ian, very few of people like you and me who've actually been there can sort of half put a sentence together. And I was a journalist, and I put in about 8 years at it.
We should let our readers know for the Times record in the Hudson Valley. So
yeah,
local boy,
yeah,
makes good here.
Yeah, and at the Omaha World Herald, which had an Iowa edition also. And I shifted over for a number of reasons, but one of which was that journalism in its purest form, in its highest form, is a matter of identifying systemic flaws with an eye towards correcting them. But the correction is a matter of making them public so that somebody else can take action, and the somebody else is generally a public official. And I wanted to get closer to the process. I don't mean to dismiss the Fourth Estate and the First Amendment. Obviously, it's a pillar of all we do. But there is an immediacy that you get from being there, that much of a check on power as the Fourth Estate is, you're not going to get inside that men's room or inside that car with a sucking candy.
And, of course, from the point of view of the craft of fiction, it's these telling details, whether real or imagined, which are really create a character, because our view of people and their it's almost a case of filling in the dots, because it's these pointless details that we build the pictures from, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's right, Ian, but I'll take it a step further, which is to say that it's these details, these inside observations are especially key in politics, which is a world of show business. It is said, maybe Joe Leno said it first, that Washington is Hollywood for ugly people, meaning all these guys put on, guys generic, men and women, in public office and public life, running for election, put on faces. Very quick example, if you will, Grandy, who's one of my heroes, I went to, on that gubernatorial campaign, I was sitting through, it must have been his fourth, maybe his fifth town hall of the day, where he was going through basically the same routine for the fourth or fifth time. Now, Grandy was a stage actor, so he was probably used to this, but I was sitting there sort of shifting my feet, doing all I could to stay awake. And afterward, Grandy came up to me and said, "Smile." And I thought he was sort of being fatherly. I thought that was cute. He saw I wasn't enjoying myself. He was concerned. And I said, "Yeah." He said, and then he leaned in close, and he said, when people think you're having a good time, they want to be with you. When they think you're about to have a heart attack, they say, yeah, well, good luck. Now smile. So the trick, Ian, is to get behind the smile. And that's not going to get you a bestseller. It's not going to get you a book published. But it's going to get you one heck of a lot better book, probably. Or it gives you one heck of an advantage over a guy who hasn't been there.
Yeah. And, one of the qualities I've admired in politicians, admired in a sort of suck the wind through your teeth, is the ability to ignore inconvenient questions as though they weren't being asked.
Yeah, that's a talent. Sometimes it comes back to bite you. We were taught when I was depending on how you count it, 10, 12 years as a press secretary, communications director, campaigns and congressional offices, and basically we were taught, answer the question you want to answer. You don't have to necessarily answer the one that was asked, but I assume, Ian, from your point of view, if a guest dodges enough questions, that sort of gets to be the last interview. But there are.
I will be back. It's one thing on a stand-up outside to dodge a question. It's another thing entirely if you're in the studio. Then it's on record, and the dodging becomes the story if it's handled correctly.
Yeah, there's to the point about show business. This is something Spector once observed. We were watching one of his colleagues just squirm through an interview, a TV interview, and the guy was obviously being duplicitous. And Spector said, It doesn't bother me that he's lying. It bothers me he's so clumsy about it.
Yes. I can relate to that. It's like the French marshal said about Napoleon executing one of the last of the royal family. This was worse than a crime. It was a mistake. There is something to be said for a professional approach like that, detached.
Yeah, well, they give out style points in Washington, and style points count.
It's always difficult when talking about a fiction book like this, a thriller with unexpected twists, because how do you talk about it without revealing and blowing it? There is murder involved, there's sex, and handled sensitively and caressingly, of course, high politics. So 30 seconds, tell us your summary that's fit for publication.
Part of the reason that, as you said, that these characters are multidimensional, are ambiguous, is because all of us, most anybody in that game, is capable of great acts of kindness and statesmanship and philosophy, but also on the dark side, capable in a cutthroat game of extraordinary acts of viciousness and sometimes even violence. And I tried to throw it all together and to stir that cauldron and to try to give the reader a sense of just in what we still, no offense to the Brit, think of as the best possible system except all the others, what depths of depravity we can sink to if we don't consciously make an effort to follow the angels of our better nature.
So this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books. I've been talking to Charles Robbins about his book, The Accomplice, a novel, which I urge you to rush out and buy before the election and possibly even buy after the election as a post-mortem. So thanks very much, Charles.
Ian, enormous thanks to you.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.